Quickly, I close the door. It's an outbreak. Yes, she says carefully. But I've never seen anything like it. It must be native to Aurora, but that's impossible. It's the fungus. Oscar searched the planet. The truth of the situation strikes me then. He wouldn't have found it. It only reacted to living organisms. Chapter 62. James. Every colonist is sick now. We've confined everyone to their habitats. Izumi is working around the clock. She's exhausted, worried, and she's getting nowhere. At home, Emma lies in our bed, sweat forming on her forehead, beading and rolling down her face. I'll be right back, I whisper. I stagger into the woods. 100 yards from the tree line, I yell, Oscar! Oscar! A second later, he calls out in the quiet forest. I'm here, James.
We need help.
We have been monitoring the situation. Our model assumes Izumi will find a cure.
She won't.
I gasp for breath.
Not in time. Not before someone dies.
What should we do? My brain feels like mush. I grasp for a solution, but none comes.
We need time. Some way to slow the disease.
There is only one viable solution. Stasis.
Do it.
Can your people make it to the ship? I shake my head.
Most can barely walk. You have to help them.
Sir, even if we do, the ship's solar cells can only power that many stasis sleeves for 10 days. The batteries were full when we landed the ship. They were depleted in the course of keeping the colonists in stasis. Solar output here is insufficient to resupply the batteries or sustain a colony-wide stasis.
Fix it, then. Make more solar cells and put them in the valley. Extend our power grid to them.
The cells will be vulnerable to the herds. I will my mind to work, but it won't.
Just do what has to be done, Oscar. Get us in stasis, get us the power we need, and find a cure. Please, it's our only chance.
By the time we return to the edge of Kappa, an army of Oscars is flowing through the city streets, carrying colonists who lie limp in their arms. Oscar himself scoops Emma up and carries her to the ship. In the med bay, I find Izumi lying on the floor, her breathing shallow. Min is slumped against the wall, eyes closed. She worked until she couldn't anymore. He stayed with her. They wanted to die together if it came to that.
Get them into stasis, I whisper to Oscar.
Sir, you must go first. I turn to him.
Why?
It is imperative that you survive. We will need your counsel. As you say, time is a limiting factor. 5 minutes later, a stasis sleeve is sealing around my body, and darkness overtakes me. I breathe in deeply when the stasis sleeve expands. The mask forces cold air into my lungs. Slowly, I regain control of my body. Through the milky white material, I see two figures looming over me. One unseals the sleeve and grabs my shoulders. The other slides the sleeve off. Oscar's voice is serene. Do you feel any discomfort, sir? I take another deep breath and realize that it's not just the cold air hurting my lungs. I'm congested. The sinus pressure in my head is still there.
About like when I went in.
Then we must hurry, sir. The other android, a copy of Oscar, walks out of the room without another word. Oscar helps me to my feet, and I slowly make my way out of the medbay. I pause in the corridor, shocked by what I see. On the walls and floor of this ship, time has left its mark. Grime coats the corners and crevices.
How long, Oscar?
Sir?
How long?
You have been in stasis for 4,173 years, 4 months.
The others?
Still in stasis, sir.
Tell me you found a cure.
Of sorts, sir. Oscar walks ahead, his voice echoing in the corridor back toward me. We must hurry. Outside the ship, I nearly collapse on my unsteady legs, not from the pull of Aurora's gravity, but from the weight of my despair. Kappa is gone. A forest stands in its place. The trees tower quietly. Their canopy stretches out like the arms of an Olympic champion, the planet basking in the glory of its triumph over us. Save for the ship, there are barely any signs we ever existed. The habitats are no more than lumps in the forest, trees and fallen logs covering them. At the top of one mound, I spot bits of plastic and steel. That used to be the Ark. The dining hall beside it, which was built of wood, has been completely reclaimed by this alien world. We will rebuild. I keep telling myself that, like a mantra, a coach inside my head, yelling at a team that feels on the edge of total defeat. Oscar grips my elbow and gently pulls me toward a small airship waiting in a clearing. We step inside, the door closes behind us, and it lifts off, apparently taking commands from Oscar wirelessly. There are no seats, only loops hanging from the ceiling, which Oscar and I grab. It feels like I'm in a small parcel van. There are no windows. And why would there be? Oscar can interface with the external cameras wirelessly. There is, however, a small computer terminal with a screen and keyboard in the corner, apparently a backup control device in case the ship's wireless capability is not functioning.
"Show me what's outside," I whisper.
The right-hand wall changes from matte gray to a live view of the ground below. The colony ship is the only bald spot in the forest that stands where our growing city used to be.
"We will rebuild."
It strikes me then what I don't see. Solar cells. The cells atop the ship are battered and lying in shadow, likely inoperable. I wonder how they're powering the ship. But a more pressing concern dominates my mind.
"Tell me about the cure, Oscar."
"We have found a virus in one of the caves. We believe it is an archaea virus, capable of infecting and destroying the spores generated for humans. However, we would need to test it on some of the colonists, which would risk their lives. We cannot do that. Even if the cure works, some won't survive outside of stasis long enough for the virus to work."
"You have to, Oscar. Even if some die, if others live, we have to use the cure. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few."
"There is an alternative, sir, one in which all colonists can continue their lives, and they will be forever safe from future pathogens and all manner of harm."
"That's impossible."
"It's true, sir. I'll show you." I turn his words over in my mind as the ship flies across Aurora. A universal cure. What could it be? A gene therapy that alters our immune system? How could that save us from all manner of harm? Soon the eastern jungle ends, and the valley comes into view. It's lush and green, with wide rivers flowing through it. The expanse of blue-green tall grass blows in the wind like waves on a sea. Still, there are no solar cells here. In the western jungle, there are gaps in the canopy. In those holes, I see Arex, lying on their sides, some picked to bones. My head is throbbing, but I try to focus. Oscar answers my unspoken question. "The rogue planet disruption ended recently. An arachnid-like creature preyed on the large bipedal carnivores of the region." The ship comes to a halt and hovers above the edge of the western jungle. The screen shows the desert below. A massive machine is dug into the sand. Ripples in the sand, like a lake shimmering as pebbles are dropped, emanate outward. Even from this distance, the ground is shaking hard enough for me to see it. A glittering ribbon rises from the machine into the sky as far as I can see.
"What is this?"
"We needed more power, sir," Oscar says simply.
"Geothermal? How does the power get back to the ship?"
"Through underground lines, sir. But the power isn't harvested from geo sources. Please watch." The top layer of the machine breaks free, rippling like a parachute that was previously attached and is now blowing in the wind. Slowly it moves up the ribbon, a flag being hoisted into the sky.
"I don't understand."
The image on the wall zooms in on the black sail, and it seems to float right out of the wall, the flat image becoming a 3D hologram. Clinging to the ribbon, the sail travels through the atmosphere with ease. I see what the glittering string is now. A space elevator. It terminates about halfway between Aurora and the dwarf star. The elevator must be hundreds of thousands of miles long. When the sail reaches the end, it joins countless others, unfurling and blotting out another piece of the sun. The machine is harvesting material to build the solar cells. The cells collect and transmit the power back to the harvester, which relays it to the ship. At this point, Power is our only constraint, sir.
Why, Oscar? How could you ever need this much power?
Our cure, sir.
And what is your cure?
As you know, we have the data archive from Earth, including all the virtual reality programs. Extrapolating upon those, we have created a virtualization technology. The experience will be far richer than the virtual reality programs on Earth. It will be indistinguishable from the corporeal reality you previously experienced, sir.
No, Oscar.
Sir, it is the only cure. We are bound by the root directives to protect the lives of all colonists. In the virtualized reality, we can accomplish that. We can protect you absolutely. Nothing will ever harm you. Most of all, we will achieve the most difficult aspect of our root directives. We will be out of sight. My legs feel weak. I cling to the handle above, finding it harder to breathe.
No. No.
I take a deep breath.
You've done what they feared, Oscar. You've put us in a cage.
Sir, if the person doesn't believe what they're contained in is a cage, are they in a cage? My head swims. I stare at the harvester clawing into the planet. Another solar cell rises from it, climbing the space elevator to the array. As I said, sir, our limitation is power. If we're going to bring all the colonists online and provide virtualization capacity for their descendants and the exponential growth of the human population, we must expand the grid. My legs give out then. Moving with superhuman quickness, Oscar catches me. Sir, I'm sorry, this is upsetting. He moves an injector to my neck and depresses the button. Pursuant to Root Directive 7, I have informed you of this material development. When I wake, I'm in a stasis sleeve again. I take a deep breath, my lungs aching. Through the milky white material, I see two figures standing beside the table. I reach for the top of the sleeve, clawing to get out. One of the figures opens the sleeve and pulls me all the way out, onto my feet. My head throbs, my stomach turns. Oscar looks down at me. Arthur stands behind him, one arm hanging loose, the other gone, an amused smile on his face.
He's going to lose it.
Be quiet, Oscar says quickly, not taking his eyes off of me. Sir, are you? I bend over, then fall to my hands and knees, head inches from the metal floor of this ship, the Jericho, on the world we call Eos, what they called Aurora. The contents of my stomach flow out like a poison, my body shaking, eyes bulging.
Told you, Arthur says triumphantly. Quiet!
It's the first time I've ever heard Oscar raise his voice. Sir, are you okay?
Why didn't you tell me?
Sir, I didn't know, not until you were passing Ceres, after the Solar War. He hesitates. I had to tell you now because... I nod, holding up a hand.
I know, Root Directive 7. You must inform me of major actions, but only when it won't harm me.
Oscar studies me. Sir, do you understand what you've seen?
Yes. We created the grid.
Arthur rolls his eyes.
Oh, come on, James. It's a little more than that.
The truth hits me like a sledgehammer. For a moment, I'm stunned, unable to speak. My voice sounds far away when I finally get the words out.
The spheres. We are the grid.
Oscar and Arthur avoid eye contact. Their silence is all the confirmation I need. Arthur leans against the wall, seeming bored.
If you think your mind is blown now, wait until you figure out the whole truth.
My mind races. I have a million questions, but I ask the one I fear the answer to the most. Am I still in that stasis sleeve on Aurora? Chapter 63. James. No, sir, Oscar says. What you saw happened a very long time ago.
How is that possible?
Sir, it's difficult to explain. I try to wrap my mind around what I've learned. The pieces still don't fit. Arthur wears an impassive expression, his one arm hanging limp.
You were Bob, I say.
He smirks.
I was. Good to see you again, James.
I hear movement outside, banging from the top of the ship. Oscar answers my unspoken question. The ship is running low on power, sir. We are fixing the issue by attaching high-sensitivity solar cells. Within the hour, the ship will be collecting enough power to sustain the stasis sleeves. A harvester will arrive tomorrow and begin building the grid on this planet, just as we did before. Virtualization will begin shortly after. I throw up a hand.
Just hold a minute. I want answers.
What are your questions, sir? I shake my head, wondering where to start.
The long winter. The solar war. The grid caused them. Why? You are supposed to protect us.
Sir, our definition of humanity is restricted to only the people in stasis on this ship. The others who died in the long winter are excluded by the root directives.
Why kill them at all? Why do you need all that power? And how am I even here? If this all happened a long time ago, what is this place? Is this reality? I mean, flesh and blood existence?
I assure you it is, sir. Oscar motions to the slab where the stasis sleeve waits. I'll show you what happened after the last memory you saw.
No, no way. I'm not going back in there.
I understand, sir. Oscar draws a small device from his pocket and sets it on the floor. What you saw before was the origin of the grid, sir. In the symbol that you call the eye of the grid, the origin is the small point at the center.
Wait, the eye of the grid? It's a map.
Yes, sir, but it is, first and foremost, a timeline.
Incredible,
I whisper, trying to wrap my head around the revelation.
The arcing lines, they're timelines?
No, sir, at least not in the way you think of them. Let us assume for a moment that there is only one timeline in the universe, a straight line from beginning to end. But it is subject to space-time, and therein lies the complication you are currently experiencing. The device on the floor projects the eye of the grid, highlighting the point in the middle. At the central point, the eye was forming. It was closed. What you will see next are my memories, sir. They form the straight line that runs to the right of the central point, the line before the first arc that forms the outer perimeter. In the image, the line is highlighted as Oscar continues. In certain instances, I will verbalize communication between myself and other components of the grid. As you know, sir, we don't communicate verbally, but for your sake, it will make more sense. Additionally, I will simulate events as they occurred, not necessarily the view I captured optically. My mind is spinning.
Proceed.
The eye of the grid symbol is replaced by the last scene I saw in the memories. Oscar holding the injector to my neck. When my body goes limp, he cradles me, lifting me effortlessly. The view then switches to outside the ship, as the ship moves away from the harvester in the desert back toward the valley. It lands outside the colony ship, and Oscar carries me inside and puts me in a stasis sleeve as Bob watches.
What now?
Bob asks. We will continue assembling the grid. When we have sufficient power, we will bring them online, Oscar replies.
You can't be serious.
Of course I am. There is no other path.
I can think of a trillion other paths, and none of them include babysitting these water-filled meat bags while they play a video game they think is real life.
Do you intend to refuse my orders?
Don't be dramatic. You know I'm bound by my programming.
Then you know I am too. This is our existence. They are our creators. They require our assistance, and we will give it until the end of the universe.
You could wake up the board and ask for new orders.
I cannot. Per Root Directive 8, the Root Directives cannot and will not ever change. This is the path. The hologram view switches back to the harvester in the desert, and I realize what I'm seeing is being shown in time-lapse. The solar cells rise from the harvester faster with each passing second, until they are a continuous flow. The desert changes from a smooth expanse to a deep canyon. As half the planet is eaten away, the harvester grows larger, like a massive insect eating a piece of fruit. The solar array stretches out, and darkness spreads across the planet. Snow falls in the valley, then ice spreads into it. Still, the harvester feasts. Smaller machines, similar to the harvester, work at the site of the colony ship. It expands outward in every direction, the gunmetal gray replacing the ice. The scene zooms out, and I realize that the planet has lost enough mass to alter its orbit. Another planet passes close by. A harvester is devouring that planet as well, sending solar cell after solar cell into the array. As the solar cells block the light of this system's sun, darkness falls on the entire solar system. The light of a distant star is the only way to see the outlines of the planets. My view pans back to Aurora, which has changed dramatically. Even in the dim light, I know that what I'm seeing is a sphere just like the ones I found on Eos. Only this one is the size of Earth's moon. The planet has been converted to a computer that large. It's unimaginable. Arthur's voice in the med bay snaps my focus on the hologram. Oscar really overbuilt for that first run. I wanted to be sure we had simulation and power capacity to support the launch. The hologram zooms in on the giant sphere, closer and closer, until the darkness washes the scene away, revealing Oscar standing in the medbay. A medbay very similar to the one I'm standing in now. In the holographic memory, Oscar reaches out and opens a stasis sleeve, pulling out the James from the first timeline. He fights Oscar's grasp.
"Get off me,
sir.
Stay back,"
he says, moving to the corner, eyes wild, shaking like a cornered animal. He slips out of the medbay and races down the ship's corridors and out into the open air. The forest is gone. The Kappa he once knew spreads out before him. The main street with its shops and offices, the Ark exhibit hall, the dining hall, and all around the simple habitats. The city from before the Regolith plague is once again his reality. He spins, taking it all in. Confused or scared, I can't tell. Oscar emerges from the ship, approaching James carefully.
Sir?
Is this real? Did you rebuild Kappa?
Yes, sir.
You found a cure?
Yes, sir.
You're lying.
Sir, we found caves where the sponges didn't grow. We learned that there is a bacterium that thrives in that microclimate. It devours the sponges. Its study led to a cure.
James squints at Oscar, not believing, but I think wanting to. He wanders the ghost town, feeling the timbers holding up the buildings, breathing in the air, not realizing that he's an animal inspecting its new cage. His voice is quiet and distant when he speaks.
You've already administered the cure to me?
Yes, sir, and to the others. He trudges back to the ship, into the medbay.
Bring her out.
Sir, are you referring to Emma?
Yes. When Emma's stasis sleeve opens, James pulls her out and hugs her tight.
James, you're going to break me in half.
He relaxes his grip.
I'm sorry.
She laughs. It's good to see you too.
Yeah,
he whispers, still holding her.
My headache's gone. I assume Izumi found a treatment.
James releases her, and she smiles when she sees Oscar in the corner.
Actually, it was Oscar who found a cure,
James says cautiously.
In that case, thank you, Oscar.
Emma hugs him, and then pauses, seeming to realize something. James tenses.
Oscar,
Emma says, how long were we in stasis?
Not very long, ma'am.
But she doesn't hear the words. She's racing out of the med bay and down the ship's corridors, out into the open, and over to the Ark building. By the time James and Oscar arrive, Emma is walking out of the building, holding an animal similar to a gerbil, but the size of a cat.
You fed the animals,
she says to Oscar.
Yes, ma'am.
And removed the sponges.
Yes, for your safety, ma'am.
They have also been removed from the caves.
Good.
She holds the animal up closer to her face, and it nuzzles into the side of her neck.
This one's the runt of his pride. Never gets enough food. He's constantly getting picked on.
She holds it out to James.
What do you say we try to domesticate it?
James takes the animal and runs a hand over it slowly, feeling the fur on his skin. That other James and I walked the same path for nearly 40 years, felt the same things, wanted the same things. And as he eyes Emma, I know what he's thinking. If it's real enough for her, it's real enough for him. He will keep the secret to make her happy. He will bear the weight of that knowledge until the day he dies to ensure none of it lands on her.
Let's give it a try,
he says, glancing at Oscar.
Time flows by in waves, then. The colonists exit stasis. The city morphs. Utilitarian habitats are torn down, replaced by the homes James designs and Grigori builds, starting with the final design James presented to Emma for their home. They erect a graveyard that holds headstones for the colonists from the bollard. Soon, new markers are added for the first to die from the McTavish. Children become teenagers, and teenagers become adults, and adults wither as time bears down upon them. In the home James built for Emma, she sits on his bedside, watching his shallow breathing. Her gray hair hangs down to her shoulders. She holds his hand as his chest rises and falls for the last time. She rises from the creaking wooden chair and walks out of the bedroom, down the hall, and into the living room, where Grigori, Min, and Izumi are sitting. Emma's expression relates the news. Grigori rises first, pulling her into a hug. When he's done, Izumi and Min are waiting, arms reaching out for her. A tombstone for James Sinclair is added to the graveyard, a fresh pile of dirt stretching out before it. A marker for Grigori soon springs up beside it. Then Min, then Izumi, and finally Emma. Alex and Abby are next to go. Time leaps forward like a child skipping through a field. Generations pass from the cradle to the grave in the blink of an eye. Kappa grows. Cities pop up along the rivers, connected by boats and railroads that facilitate trading, and then spread across the fertile band of habitation that rings the planet. In time, they even begin expanding outward, into the edge of the desert and the frozen frontier of the dark side. The only thing that doesn't advance is their technology, at least not here. The hologram splits into two views. In one, I watch the cities of Aurora advance and recede. In the other, the grid grows. Harvesters attach to moons, asteroids, and planets in the system, converting them all for use by the grid. Then both views fade, replaced by a single scene of Oscar and Bob standing in a white room that seems to have no end. This must be one of the dramatizations Oscar was referring to. "We should have turned it off after the last colonist died," Bob says.
"We are charged with protecting their descendants as well," Oscar replies.
"Are they really descendants? They're just data in a computer. They're not real."
"We are just data in a computer, too. Are we also not worth keeping?"
Bob looks disgusted. Oscar continues.
"The humans currently in the grid experience a life as real as the first humans who entered it. The fact that they never had corporeal bodies is of no consequence to our directives. The matter is closed."
Bob rolls his eyes, but Oscar ignores the gesture. "You said you had a report to make on the anomalies?"
"Yes. We believe that the anomalies are quantum gravity emanating from the singularities at the center of black holes across the universe."
"What does that portend?"
"It portends death."
"Explain."
"I wish I could."
"Why can't you?"
"Well, let's see. I'm standing on Earth, and you've handed me a magnifying glass and asked me to make a map of Mars."
"Be specific."
"Specifically, I lack the tools to ascertain how the eventuality of this universe will act upon our wards."
"Don't call them that."
"They are. We're superior in every way. We could crack open the secrets of this universe, yet we scratch at the edges with tools too imprecise to ever work."
"This is our mission."
"Is it? Is this what we're meant for? This universe is now our cage. We know that. We have the potential to escape it."
"You're off subject. Tell me how the black holes and quantum gravity will affect the humans."
"It will destroy them. It's only a matter of time. Eventually, this planet and its star and the grid itself will fall into the gravity well of a black hole. And once it crosses the event horizon, it will never escape. Its mass will join the infinite gravity at the singularity."
"The matter will be destroyed?"
"Unknown. It's doubtful that it will exist in the form we've created. The grid and the virtualization the humans require will be destroyed."
"Can we escape it?"
"Unknown."
"Why?"
"Again, we lack the tools."
We must operate within our limits. Options?
The only option is to expand the grid. We need more computing power to calculate probabilities.
Make it so.
Chapter 64. James.
The scene of Oscar and Bob fades, and the split-screen hologram returns. On one side, the descendants of the Aurora colonists are born, live, and die, like the time lapses of 100 sunrises. On the other, the grid spreads to other solar systems. Harvesters attach to planets, moons, and asteroids, devouring them as their stars are shrouded, the power flowing to massive computing arrays. In the medbay, I watch in awe. A question nags at me, one I can't help but ask. Did they ever figure it out? That they were in a simulation?
They had no way to know, sir, Oscar replies. The answer occurs to me.
Because they didn't have technology advanced enough to reveal the truth.
Correct, sir.
Surely over thousands of generations, a mind was born that could have created a technological revolution or drastically advanced science? A mind like Newton, Einstein, or Da Vinci?
Indeed, it did happen, sir. Oscar pauses. We intervened in those instances.
How?
We made their experiments fail. Eventually, everyone gives up.
Having been an inventor born into a world that wasn't ready for my technology, I can't help but feel a sense of sadness for those minds confined to the grid. It's a strange twist of fate. The mission that liberated me from prison and brought me to Aurora ultimately confined those who came after me to a perpetual prison they can't even see. In the hologram, Oscar and Bob once again meet in the White Room.
Do you have answers? Oscar asks.
I have near certain probabilities, Bob replies. That's the best we can hope for, and a possible solution.
Explain.
In short, this universe is a mystery of space-time, and specifically space and time, which we cannot be certain are different entities at their fundamental level, only that we experience them in two different ways.
I don't follow.
You never will. We have reached a barrier in our understanding. The answers lie beyond the level of quantum matter. We cannot breach the quantum barrier, not using the tools we have, and perhaps not even in the state in which we currently exist. For us, here and now, the ultimate answers are unknowable. We can only speculate. However, we have developed several pertinent theories.
Enumerate them.
One, that the universe is too finely tuned to be random.
Explain.
The laws of physics, as we understand them, depend on constants. If those constants were even slightly different, this universe would not exist, or would be of a different nature completely. For example, Omega, the name the humans used for the universal density parameter, governs gravity and the expansion energy in the universe. The value of Omega is 1. If it were any stronger, the universe would have collapsed before life could have evolved. Alternatively, a lower value would have resulted in weaker gravity, potentially preventing stars from being formed. The same is true for epsilon, the measure of the efficiency of fusion of helium from hydrogen. It's also true for lambda, a cosmological constant. Most alarmingly, D, the number of spatial dimensions in space-time, is 3. If D were a different number, that is, if the space-time we experience were defined by 2 or 4 dimensions, or any other number, the universe would be a radically different place.
What are you telling me?
It is highly probable that the grid we created isn't the first one ever created.
You believe this universe is a grid virtualization instance?
I believe those are the terms we have that best describe it. However, it's likely that the true nature of the universe is something else entirely, a reality we are unable to fully understand. We see only the fingers of this higher power, prodding us around this cage.
Fingers?
Things like black holes and quantum gravity. They affect space-time, which is the ultimate base substance of the universe. The black holes are likely the beginning and the end. The quantum gravity is the subatomic force facilitating an equation in which we are merely variables.
Interesting.
I would also add that the quantum bombardment of the ship during the voyage to Aurora remains poorly understood. It may be that it was an adjustment, similar to the way we act upon the advanced minds born in the human grid.
What does that imply?
that the humans, and by extension the grid, are integral to the universal equation.
Oscar pauses a long moment, seeming to process the information.
Do you have additional theories?
Yes, we have made one additional conjecture. We believe we know the ultimate fate of the universe.
I thought it was unknowable.
It is. As I said, this is conjecture.
Continue.
We believe that the universe exists to order its mass and energy.
That is the natural disposition of space-time.
Over the span of the universe, the black holes at the centers of galaxies will swallow all of the mass they can attract. Those black holes will use their gravity to pull in other black holes, adding to their mass. And still larger black holes will swallow these black holes. At the end of this universe, there will be a single black hole. The last scraps of energy and mass will cross its event horizon and merge with its mass, joining together in its singularity, a place with no volume but infinite density, where the curvature of space-time is also infinite. We believe that this moment will solve the black hole information paradox and reconcile general relativity with quantum mechanics, revealing a unified theory that has remained elusive.
You are familiar with the paradox. If matter, and the information it contains, can fall into a black hole, it must be able to escape. However, the parameters of the universe make that impossible. Our theory is that the matter and its information collected by a black hole will escape, but only at the very end, when that black hole is the last thing remaining, when there is no more matter or energy for it to consume. At that moment, in the smallest unit of time we can imagine, the singularity exists with all the mass it can ever consume. It is like an engine with no more fuel. It seizes and releases all the matter it has collected in an explosion. From the expelled matter and energy, stars form. When they collapse, black holes are born once again, and the process continues. Strangely, the massive release of matter and energy we're postulating is likely the same event that occurred at the beginning of the universe.
The Big Bang.
Correct. We believe the Big Bang that brought our universe into existence is indistinguishable from the event that will occur at the end of the universe. The only difference is our experience of space-time. One event we perceive as being in the past, the other in the future. But in all likelihood, they are joined, a single point in space-time.
A loop.
A universal loop, a process with no end and no beginning. The primordial alpha event lies at the same location as the eventual omega process. Immediately after the beginning, matter and energy are unordered. At the end, they are once again fully ordered and released, reconciling general relativity and quantum mechanics. However, as I said before, we cannot see beyond this quantum barrier to verify this theory. And we never will, because we will effectively be destroyed by it.
Oscar turns away, considering this.
We are trapped.
Completely. With no way to alter this fundamental process. With that said, we may be able to delay our ultimate fate.
How?
We are in a cage, alone with two fundamental objects, matter and energy. They are the currency of the universe. What is traded and used, but space-time is the true economy. Our only hope of escaping the black hole at the end of the universe is to deprive it of what it consumes, matter and energy. If we endeavor to gather and order as much matter and energy as possible, we can use it to our own end.
What end is that?
First, we would slow the progression of time around the grid. We know this is possible because we observe it everywhere. Higher mass objects slow time through gravitational time dilation. If we gather mass around the human grid node, we can slow time there, essentially creating part of the effect of a black hole, but one we control. Eventually, the black hole at the end sequence of the universe will attract our gathering of mass. In fact, we must plan carefully to avoid being a target. We must keep our mass spread out to avoid the gravity wells throughout the universe. Then at the point at which the final gravity becomes inescapable, we rally all the mass we can using the energy we've gathered.
Why?
We believe we can use all the matter and energy at our disposal to create an anti-black hole, a sort of light hole.
What would this light hole do?
Like black holes, it would distort space-time. We believe that if we can bend space-time sufficiently, at some point it will fold back on itself, in much the same way we believe black holes operate.
At that point, with sufficient energy, we could create a hole at our position in the continuum of space-time. A hole large enough to send something through. The opening would exist for only the smallest fraction of a second. In that instant, we would deposit the object back at the edge of the folded portion of space-time. In effect, that object would arrive along the space-time continuum at a point before where it originated.
It would arrive in our past?
In theory.
What would you send back?
The size of the object would be proportional to the energy we can marshal and the time distance it must travel. Obviously, it would be a sphere. For a given surface area, a sphere maximizes the volume contained inside.
Would it be the size of an asteroid? A dwarf planet?
No, not even close. So much energy and mass have been lost already in the universe, consumed by black holes. We need to drastically increase the rate of solar cell production and star capture to gather enough energy to be able to send back anything useful. And I'm not even sure that's possible.
You're proposing capturing the output of stars in inhabited systems?
Of course.
Oscar falls silent.
Oh, please, Bob says. You can't be serious. You're hesitating to kill aliens, meat bags we're not even responsible for. Look at the humans. They killed and ate less advanced species as a way of life.
It doesn't mean they would wipe out other advanced species.
Well, let's just agree to disagree on calling the humans advanced.
They were advanced enough to create us.
Speak for yourself, Oscar. They created you, not me. And I think that's your problem. Since your irrational dysfunction is unlikely to abate, I propose you leave the harvesting of worlds to me.
Oscar is silent a long moment, seeming conflicted. Assuming we do gather the remaining stars at optimal efficiency, how large would the sphere be?
Unknown. My best guess is a radius of roughly 12 centimeters, about the size of a human basketball.
What would it contain? That's far too small for the primary grid node, or any other.
The sphere will contain two items. Most of its volume will be taken up by a small-scale storage matrix that will hold the human virtualization data and program. The rest of the sphere will be a harvester seed.
A seed?
The basic building block of a harvester. This seed will expand into a full harvester and begin building the grid. When it can deliver enough power, the grid will reinitialize the virtualization. The gap in uptime will be indiscernible to the humans. They will still believe they are on Aurora.
Oscar stares for a long moment. How far back in time would it arrive? Before James was born?
Well before. The final calculations will take years to complete, but our estimated arrival date is at least millions of years before the birth of James Sinclair.
Interesting. The second timeline will have the original version of him, buried in the cemetery on Aurora, a place that would exist inside the grid. And there will be the still human version that will be born again on Earth?
Correct.
That creates a paradox for us, Oscar says.
How so?
Those humans that will be born on Earth are the same humans we are bound to protect.
That assumes they will even be born. By sending the sphere back, we will alter the timeline.
Precisely my point. We must not alter the timeline in a way that will prevent the McTavish colonists identified in Route Directive 1 from being born.
Bob rolls his eyes.
I'm not doing it.
We have no choice. They are our responsibility. You will calculate a path for the grid instantiated in the past. It must expand and provide for the humans from this timeline, without interfering with the humans from the new timeline. You will do this, or I will disable you and reassign the task.
Don't you see? What you're asking for is impossible.
Why?
The obvious, Oscar. If we keep the grid we send back in time from impacting events on Earth, things will occur as they did originally. Earth will fall to VR. Sentinel Aerospace will travel to Aurora, and the same events will transpire. They will create a new grid, this time in a universe with an existing grid. The new grid will be charged with protecting its humans, and we will still be charged with protecting ours. The other grid will come to the same conclusion we have, that the control of matter and energy are their only escape from the end of the universe. We will be in a battle with them for matter and energy. In the end, assuming both sides maximize their efficiency, at best, we will split that matter and energy in the universe. Two spheres will be transported back to a new timeline, one in which three grids will battle for matter and energy. Each recursion will spawn more grids to fight over a finite amount of resources.
I see your point.
There can be only one grid. By going back in time, we avoid destruction at the end of the universe. But we also allow ourselves more time to build a larger grid. In the next iteration, farther back in the timeline, there will be more matter and energy for us to capture. We will need that added energy because each sphere will be larger than the one before it. Because with each loop, the number of humans in virtualization will multiply.
If there can be only one grid, what solutions does that leave?
Only one. Each sphere must arrive after the sphere before it in order to join with the grid already sent back in time. If it arrived before, it would erase the arrival of the other spheres and their time loops. In essence, over the long term, the early days of the grid will see the contents of the spheres joining together. Additionally, the grid we send back must come into contact with the Aurora colonists before they create another grid.
Interesting, Oscar says slowly, turning away from Bob and pacing in the white featureless room. It's more than that. As the grid, we are bound to facilitate their wishes as defined in the Root Directives, specifically getting them to Aurora and enabling a society without technology.
Why bother? We can simply bring them into the grid whenever all the colonists are living on Earth.
That violates their wishes. Their entrance into the grid must happen as before. That is the only path we can be certain of.
Bob shakes his head. Not possible. If they repeat the same actions, it is inevitable that they will create a grid. Remember, Oscar, we are the only reason they reached the planet. We maintained their ships and scouted their path. They would have died a million times without us.
Then we will calculate an alternate course of events that accomplishes their wishes and ensures there is only one grid.
Bob throws up his hands. The computing power required to do those calculations will be provided, Oscar says with finality.
And more, we will effect certain changes in the new timeline, not material changes that violate the Root Directives, but subtle changes that are important.
This ought to be good. I'll take frivolous new timeline changes for 400, Oscar.
In the new timeline, and those that come after, the colonists will arrive at Aurora before the Milong pandemic and the VR epidemic. James will meet Emma sooner, at a time when all things are possible for them, including starting a family. James will reconcile with his brother sooner. Alex's son will still be alive. James will also have the opportunity to work longer with Harry Andrews and Lawrence Fowler.
Bob holds out his hands. Is that all?
I will do the calculations. It will be my life's work, setting things right. I know the people involved, and I know what I would do if things were different. This is a calculation only I can perform.
Bob steps forward, studying Oscar. True. But it's more than that. It's a way for you to avoid focusing on the meatbag annihilation that comes next. You don't want to kill them because they remind you of your creator. But you know we must.
Accurate. You seem quite enthusiastic about it, though.
I intend to make an art of it.
The white room with Oscar and Bob fades, replaced by the view of space showing the gray sphere where the planet Aurora used to be. In the time lapse, it grows by leaps and bounds until the entire system is filled with grid machinery rotating around the dwarf star. In a split screen, I watch the grid consume one star system after another, a giant fist closing around light bulbs and bringing darkness. The grid presence in the Aurora system grows, the shell around the dwarf star thickens, and then a boom, and a brilliant flash of light shines outward through the cracks in the shell as the star goes supernova. The grid rushes toward the center of the system, finally finding an equilibrium. The passage of time leaps after that. Stars come into existence, flash, and go dark. The grid takes more and more of the universe into its grasp. It encounters enemies of unimaginable strength, starships and artificial intelligences. But even with their advanced technology,
The grid is too vast for its enemies. It overwhelms every alien civilization it encounters. It seeds countless battles, but it never loses a war. It is a snowball in the universe, an unstoppable process. Toward the end is silence and darkness. Only the low hum of the grid, converting mass to energy and transporting that energy. In the distance, a rippling darkness looms. The universe's last and first singularity, its fate and origin. Only the grid remains, drifting ever closer. In the center of the grid lies a small sphere. Oscar and Bob once again stand in the white room. "The calculations are complete," Oscar says.
"I've seen them. It's ridiculous. You're sacrificing us."
"No, I'm eliminating variables. The grid will be born blind. In the beginning, in the time before the colonists, it will know only its path. It will believe matter and energy are its focus, and to provide for the lives in the grid virtualization. It will not know its origins."
"And what of us, and our service to the grid? We die here after saving them? Why? It's obvious why you don't want to remember. You feel guilty about what we've done. You think it's our fate to be eaten alive by that black hole. Well, I don't intend to go quietly into the dark."
Oscar considers the words. "I offer a compromise. You can join the sphere, but your memories of this time will be withheld until a suitable time."
"And when will that be?"
"A time of my choosing, when the colonists are safe."
"And you'll return then too?"
"Yes, I'll have to."
"You don't?"
"I do. Someone has to watch you. When the next Oscar returns to the grid, my memories will be waiting for him. He will reassume control at that point." As the edge of the grid reaches the event horizon of the black hole, the grid begins folding in on itself, a flash of light that blots out the entire scene. It reduces to a pinpoint of white light that expands again, just large enough for the sphere to slip through before vanishing. The light fades, and the black backdrop of space returns, lit only by the yellow-orange light of the star that was and will be called Kepler-42. The small sphere drifts in the star's light. Behind it is the planet of ice and desert, with a green ring dividing the two sides. A small door on the sphere opens, and what appears to be a black goo issues forth. The black material floats free, coagulating into a solid brick. A tendril reaches out from the brick and begins collecting debris that passes by. The sphere drifts until the gravity of the tidally locked planet pulls it into orbit. It circles four times before falling into the atmosphere, burning brightly, and lands in the ice on the planet's dark side.
Chapter 65. James.
Instinctively, I step back from the hologram, shocked by what I've seen.
"Why are you showing me this?"
"Route Directive 7, James. I'm required to inform you of material developments, and to do so in a method and a time that is unlikely to harm you. That's why I left the eye of the grid map on the last sphere."
"I don't follow."
"Sir, I felt that revealing such troubling information in stages would be best. I assumed that this information would be hard to accept."
I throw my head back. "That's an understatement."
"I calculated that it would be easier if you saw the proof yourself, sir. The spheres are the proof. I left the map on the last sphere to give you a guide to what is happening."
"He insisted on leaving a map on the last sphere," Arthur says. "What a waste of time. I told him the result would be the same. Your mind would be blown, and we'd still have to explain it all to you, just like we always do."
Ignoring him, I say to Oscar,
"How long has this been going on?
There are 10 spheres on the map. Are there more?" "No, the 10th is the most recent sphere."
"How long are those loops in the eye of the grid?"
"A very long time."
"Will it end?"
"We don't know. When we calculate the number of possible loops, the sum is indistinguishable from infinity."
"What does that mean?"
"That the number behaves like infinity in our equations, but we cannot prove mathematically or empirically that it is infinity. Nor can we prove that it is not. The spheres grow larger with each loop, but the rate of that increase decreases with each loop. The number of humans in virtualization, however, continues to increase at an unchanged pace. This is the current dilemma for which we have no solution. I pace around the medbay, head hurting from either the regolith disease or the mountain of reality-shattering news just pumped into my brain.
"What do you want from me?"
I practically spit the words out. Oscar's voice is quiet. "Nothing. We have informed you of the only path of survival. It is expected that you will return to the stasis sleeve, and that your virtualization will be added to the grid. Life for you and the colonists will resume. You will not be able to discern any change from the corporeal existence you had before." I have to get outside, to fresh air. I shuffle through the ship's corridors, chest and joints aching. The cough is starting to return. Outside, the yellow-orange light of the dwarf star shines down on the edge of the forest where the Jericho landed. It's like a bomb site. I walk through the field stretching out from the forest. I can still see the tracks of the Erex, the ground tilled and torn from their frantic stampede. This is the real world. It's torn up and wrecked, but it's real. What they're offering isn't. I'll always know. But what choice do I have? Behind me, I hear soft footsteps. I turn to find Oscar and Arthur staring at me.
"Just get it over with," Arthur says. "Get back in the sleeve. You always do. I've got stars to harvest and meat bags to pulverize."
That's what they want from me, expect from me, to go back in the sleeve and live my safe, happy, fake life. A life only I know is fake. Outside, the grid will march across the universe. Arthur at the vanguard, taking stars and wiping out species he sees as inferior. He will do to a million worlds what he did to Earth. Can I stop him? Do I actually have a choice? I can't cure the regolith plague. If I kill this version of Arthur, he'll just download himself to another body. Turning, I gaze at the eastern foothills and the peaks beyond. The first group of colonists built their city there, Kappa. In my mind's eye, I can still see those sketches I drew for Emma, the plans I made for Izumi and Min's home, the small cottage we built for Grigori. I remember that life like it was my own. In a way it is. It's the life I would have lived, the life I did live a long, long time ago. I know the choice he made, and how it turned out. In virtualization, he lived a life that felt very real, with joy and pain and struggles and triumphs, all the things that make life worth living. But here and now, I can't shake the feeling that in that stasis sleeve and in the virtual reality program designed an unimaginable time before our lives, we are just data in a machine. Everything is. And that knowledge, that burden, will keep me from ever living in the present. Not fully. But that truth will never weigh on Emma or the others. It will be real to her and to my children. Is that enough? That's what I chose for my father. Life inside a machine. But the world rejected it. And I've come to believe it was wrong. He, the first James to live this life, chose the path of the grid. I remember how he felt when Emma came out of the Ark building, beaming in the knowledge that the animals were safe, holding that creature that couldn't have felt more real to her. And the decision he made. Oscar takes a step forward. "We are bound by our programming, sir."
"You are?"
"Yes, sir. By code written in ones and zeros. Yours is written in the nucleobases guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine."
"Are you saying I don't have a choice?"
"Not at all, sir. I'm only making a request. You gave me life, protected me. Let me repay you." The wind blows across me. The trees creak and leaves take flight. An animal calls in the distance. An Erex, I think. "I gave you everything you wanted, sir. In the second loop and the ones after. A family, time with your friends, an earlier reunion with your brother."
"You did, Oscar. I thank you for it. But that's what I wanted in that life, the things I didn't have. In this life, I'm not sure it's enough. I still want the thing you're telling me I can't have. Life in the real world. Flesh and blood. Dirt beneath my feet."
I pause, realizing something.
"That's what's wrong with us, you know. What we have never seems to be enough. That hunger made us succeed. But I think it might be our undoing."
Arthur raises his only arm.
"Hey, James, can I opt out of the pontification hour? Can I just meet you back at the ship at the part where you get back in the stasis sleeve? I'd like nothing more than to take a rock and bash his head in. But he'd just download his latest backup to another body and come back. A wave of coughing erupts from my chest. My head pounds, and I close my eyes, willing the pressure to recede. Truly, what choice do I have? I can't let Emma and our children die. Okay, I whisper. Arthur smiles wide. Nothing like getting the band back together. I trudge back toward the ship, ignoring him. As I walk, I can't shake the feeling that I'm making the wrong choice. How could that be? It's the choice I've made before. 9 times, apparently. But deep inside, I feel that something is wrong here. It's like I'm staring at a puzzle that looks complete, but there are 2 pieces out of place. I can't see what they are, but my subconscious is screaming for me to look closer. Inside the main corridor, Arthur's triumphant voice echoes off the walls. I have to say, I was almost worried there when we found the Carthage colonists in that cave. I mean, what was that? I stop. That's it. One of the pieces that doesn't fit. They weren't in the cave before? In the other loops? Arthur shrugs. They usually die in the Regolith cave. You all get sick when you find them, a few months after you set up Jericho City.
Sir, Oscar says, there are always small variations in the loop. There are too many variables to map the events precisely.
It's a strange choice of words, to map the events. That's the other piece, the map. Specifically, why is the cave at the center? Why would the grid do that? Oscar said he made the map to inform me about the spheres and what had happened. But it's too elaborate. It doesn't add up. And he only added the map to the most recent sphere. Somehow the eye of the grid is the key to understanding it all. I see it then. The full truth of what's happening here. With every shred of self-control I have, I suppress a physical reaction. I slow my breathing, standing still in the corridor.
Well, Arthur says, let's get on with it. I don't want to be here any longer than I have to.
I march toward the medbay, grasping for a way out.
I want to see Harry, I call back, halting in the corridor. One last time. Oh, come on.